You know, that song in itself is really a sermon. Greater is he that is in me than he that is in the world. You know, no one wants to come to the end of their life feeling empty, looking back and having the sense that their life has been wasted, that all that they've done has amounted to nothing. I mean, you never meet anybody who's coming to the end of their life, the winter of their years, that says, you know, I'm happy to be able to go to my grave knowing that I've successfully avoided accomplishing anything significant. You never hear anybody saying, I am so pleased that my kids will never be able to say I helped them. I mean, no one in their 80 years looks back and wants to say, I never made a difference. What most people want to be is like the person who impacted their lives, like the teacher who challenged them to stretch their thinking or to pursue their dreams, or to be like the Sunday school teacher or the pastor who taught them what it means to follow Christ, who answered their questions, who listened to their problems, even all the drama in their lives, and who prayed with them. Or they want to be like the boss who showed them the ropes, who taught them how to deal with difficult people, who helped them get promoted. People want to be the kind of people that God thanks him for putting in their lives. And here's the good news this morning. That can be you. You can be someone who helps to shape the lives of those around you. How? The answer is found in what many believe to be the oldest letter in the New Testament, 1 Thessalonians, written about 50 AD, within 20 years of Christ's crucifixion, written by Paul to a church he planted in just 3 weeks' time. And now it's 3 years later, and he's writing to them to encourage them in their worshiping of God, in their walking with God, in their working for God. A letter in which Paul gives some basic instructions of what everyday life for the believer should be, what it should look like while he's waiting for Christ's return. Now, this is a letter where Paul's concerned because he just spent so little time planting this church. They were baby believers, so he thought there was a chance they might get some things wrong in the faith. He was even more concerned that they might fall prey to false teachers or to abandon the faith in the face of opposition, persecution from their own families, from rival religions in the town, maybe even from city officials who were concerned that this new faith, this new movement might upset Rome because, as the Jews were claiming, hey, these Christians, they're claiming Jesus as their king, not Caesar. And yet you look how Paul commended the believers in Thessalonica. In chapter 1, verse 7, he said, he commends them for being examples. Literally, the word is for being a model to all the Christians in Greece. In other words, Christians everywhere, he's saying, would do well to imitate their faithfulness. Thinking about what everyday life for believers should look like. In verse 8, Paul said, the Lord's message rang out from them. That was a phrase that was used outside of the Bible. It was well known. It referred to a loud noise, like a thunderous clap of lightning. Or maybe a great multitude of people, or the peal of a trumpet that could be heard everywhere. And so what Paul was saying was the way they were living their lives, the example that they were giving, was causing the gospel that they believed in to spread. The gospel that they believed in, that you could put your faith in Jesus and what he did on the cross, and it would count as the penalty you deserve for your sin. It would gain you God's forgiveness and a place in paradise for eternity. They were outward-looking people who, regardless of how few of Jesus' words they knew Because remember, they were baby Christians. They were still all about being Jesus' witnesses. Somehow they realized the magnitude of Jesus' suffering, his sacrifice, the fact that he'd stepped down from glory, from heaven, to suffer the death of a common criminal for them. Well, the change they'd undergone, once they'd come to faith, they knew that it was more than just to rescue them from the hell all people deserve for the punishment of their sins. They knew that they'd been transformed to be used to bring others to know him too. A message that never would have changed them if, according to chapter 2, verse 2, Paul hadn't dared proclaim the gospel to them in the face of strong opposition. The word dared in other translations, it is a word translated as boldness or as courage. If Paul hadn't had the courage to proclaim the gospel, the good news of Jesus, God's love in him, a courage that verse 1 says kept his visit from them from being a failure, from being useless, wasted. So adding all these thoughts together, Paul was basically saying what kept him from failure and is going to proclaim the gospel was the courage God gave him. And the proof that he hadn't failed, that his efforts hadn't been wasted, was the faith of the Thessalonians. Showing how influencing others. If you want to make a difference in the lives of others, sometimes, like Paul, it may require some suffering, some sacrifice for Jesus. Verse 1, he said he'd suffered, he'd been insulted in Philippi in order to preach the gospel. According to Acts chapter 16, he was in the midst of preaching there in Philippi when all of a sudden the crowd turned on him. They turned him over to the city officials. They were stripped, they were beaten, they were tossed in jail. Yes, God did miraculously rescue him from jail, but not until after he'd been mistreated for the gospel. That seems to be a theme in Paul's ministry. As 2 Corinthians chapter 6, he kind of lists all the things that happened to him. As there, he recounted the hardships, the distresses, the beatings, the imprisonments, the riots, in which he'd been bruised and bloodied by angry mobs. Hard work, sleepless nights, hunger, coldness, shipwrecks, abandonment, persecution, dangers of all sort. Talk about the glamorous life of a missionary, right? Hey, that was Paul. But it was a price he was willing to pay to be an influence, to make a difference in the lives of others. And you know, if that's your desire to make a difference in somebody else's life, chances are God won't call you to suffer to the extreme the way he did the Apostle Paul. Oh, he may, but chances are he won't. Yet, if you are going to make a difference, be ready to suffer, maybe to have to sacrifice some time, maybe to have to endure some hard work, maybe to have to face what I'll call thoughtless and harsh criticism rather than constructive and kind criticism. You know, I think I've shared how in the church in Minnesota, at least individually I have, we had a pianist and an organist who were violently opposed to updating the music, even to adding Bill Gaither songs like Because He Lives. I mean, they saw it as the first step down the slippery slope to becoming Sodom and Gomorrah. So when I insisted that's a change we needed to make, one Sunday morning, they didn't show up. But they'd come in the night before and they had piled music all over the piano, all over the organ. That was not a fun situation to deal with, but it was a change the church needed. Folks, you may never be shipwrecked like the Apostle Paul, to have to suffer for Christ that way, but if you want to be an influence for Jesus, be prepared to suffer. Be prepared to sacrifice. But you know, that's when, in the midst of your most difficult moments, you may have your greatest impact on the lives of others, when they see you keep on keeping on in the face of hardship, difficulties, when others quit, that's when your faith and commitment will have its greatest impact. Maybe on your children, maybe on a coworker, maybe on others right here in the church. And for those wondering, hey, where does the courage come from? Well, Paul's pretty clear. The courage to do what he did comes from God. Verse 2, he said, when we had previously suffered and been insulted in Philippi. Now, the description that's given here about them being stripped, beaten, thrown in jail, that was a form of punishment called verbatio. I'm not pronouncing that correctly. Verbatio. And it was something that was reserved for the worst of criminals. Roman citizens were never subjected to this, of being stripped naked, paraded through the street, beaten with rods, bloodied, and then thrown in jail. An act so degrading, again, Roman citizens weren't allowed to suffer it. So when Paul said, with the help of our God, we dared preach again, we had the courage to do it again, he shows the magnitude of the courage that God gave him to keep on keeping on, to face another audience, where we know from Acts chapter 17, he almost suffered the same fate there in Thessalonica. But with his life given over to God, trusting in him, with his hope in the Lord, God gave him the courage he needed to do what he called him to do. And you know, God will give you that same courage as you trust in him. Romans 8:15 says, Paul doesn't give us a spirit. I mean, God doesn't give us a spirit to fear that enslaves us to fear. Instead, he gives us the spirit of sonship. He gives us the gift of being his child. And don't you think he's going to watch over his children? And I mean, that's the ultimate reward for staying faithful to the end, isn't it? To being God's child, if you endure. As Paul went on three verses later in verse 18 to say, at the end, when you'll know that your present sufferings were not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. Your present sufferings, they won't even compare to the glory that will be revealed in us. Do you believe this? You have to if you want to make a difference in the lives of others. Oh, and when Paul said his courage to declare the gospel came from God, RSV, verse 3, that's the better translation. He said, our appeal does not spring from error or uncleanness, nor it is made from guile. In other words, his influence flowed out of his integrity, out of his honesty, out of the kind of person that he was, that people could see the kind of person that he was. The word uncleanness equates to sexual impurity. So Paul's ability to influence others was found in the kind of life he lived, the kind of person he was. You know, I was with ConAgra, and I always wondered how the company could expect their employees to trust them when the chairman of the board would be caught lying. Public statement saying, we have no plans to close any production facilities that we've just purchased or to lay anyone off. And when I got back to my office, there was a note. A meeting's being held in which we're going to go over the plans to close the production facilities and lay people off. He didn't word it that way exactly, but that was the gist of it. The example that guy set. What kind of influence did it have? Or better yet, how can a pastor preach on generosity if he's not a generous person? You get the gist. The influence you have on others is the kind of example you set. So the question is, what kind of an example are you? Talking about integrity leads to talking about having the courage to please God rather than people. Verse 4, Paul said his motivation for preaching the gospel was not to please men, but God. Verse 6, he added, we were not looking for praise from men. I mean, he knew you can't please everyone all the time. You just can't. But isn't it human nature to try? I mean, we want everybody to be happy with us. And on the flip side, we don't want anybody to be upset with us. But you know, when pleasing others is your main goal, that's going to limit your ability to always do the right thing and not the popular thing. That's going to limit your ability to always say the right thing and not the popular thing. A people pleaser is always subject to the whims of those he leads, those he helps, those he ministers to. When pleasing others is your main goal, they're bound to have more influence on you than you will have on them. Your main concern is never to upset anyone. And you know, I confess, as a pastor, this is something I struggle with. I think all pastors do. You got to understand there's a balance, there's a choice. And when I deal with people, you know, how much or what can you say as far as it being the right thing? The right thing to help correct a person's attitude or behavior or to avoid downplaying the seriousness of somebody's sin. I mean, it's always a balance, a choice. Do you say what needs to be said, or are you gracefully just going to kind of let it go? Because especially in this day and age, people are so sensitive. They get offended so easily, and they leave a church so easily. And you know, that hurts when you see someone leaving a church. It hurts when they leave for being told something they really needed to hear. It hurts when they leave because they just didn't get their way. Small, trivial things. It's impossible to please people all the time. But you know, you can always please God by doing the right thing. By doing the right thing. When you make an unpopular but necessary decision, God's going to be pleased. Even if what you do might upset your child. Even if what you do might upset a co-worker. Even if what you do might upset your spouse. Others in the church, and they're disgruntled for a time, yet God will be pleased because you have done the right thing. And ultimately, isn't it God's opinion that counts? God's opinion that counts. And more often than not, maybe in doing the right thing, again, that may have more of a positive influence on people than if you'd done the popular thing. When you ask God for direction, do you ever tag on to that request that you want to do the right thing and not just the popular thing? Because quite frankly, doing the popular thing rather than doing the right thing may have, well, unfavorable consequences at times. I mean, I think about a music teacher. If the music teachers, our sons had, hadn't pushed them when they complained about being pushed, would they have been prepared for auditions when they got into school and things like that? They'd have been ill-prepared if they hadn't pushed them to prepare them. Or when a parent wanting to be her child's best friend, and I think that's something that happens in this day and age, too many parents want to be their child's best friend. They're not supposed to be. They're the parent. The parent. But when they try to be the child's best friend, sometimes they overlook behavior that they shouldn't. And maybe it brings peace in the house, but you know, when that child gets to school and that behavior's still there, how are the other students, how the teacher is going to treat that child? Better to have it corrected in the home than elsewhere. And how about when we overlook someone being negative all the time? Say, you know, you overlook that. Well, all of a sudden you notice that person doesn't have any friends. So sometimes doing the right thing, even though we suffer for it, it may be the thing that really has an influence on others. So always seek God, always seek his courage to do what's right. And of course, Paul also suggested the greatest influence you can have on others requires the courage to share your life with others. Verse 8, Paul said, we loved you so much that we're delighted to share with you not only the gospel of God, but our lives as well, because you had become so dear to us. You know, that tells us two things, doesn't it? If you really want to make an influence on people's lives, it takes love. Not romantic love, but love in the sense that you want to see somebody go from despair to hope. You want to see somebody go from sorrow to joy. You want to see somebody go from living a wasted life to a meaningful, fulfilled life. You care about where people are headed. Heaven or hell? Because if you don't love people, there's no way you're really going to share your life with them and really be an influence on them. Which leads to the second thing that Paul was saying here. He was saying you never really influence another person without investing yourself in that person. You've got to invest yourself in that person to take the time to get to know the person, to know what's happening in that person's life, and to share things in your own life if you're really going to have an influence. You've got to let down your guard. Invite the person you hope to influence into your life. You know, I was in business. And I had a coworker come in to me one day. And she said her cat was sick. And she knew enough about me. I shared enough about myself. She knew I was a Christian. And she asked if I would pray with her for her sick cat. Now, I know some of you are cat lovers. I'm allergic to cats. I admit they're not my favorite animals. But this was important to her. And so I prayed with her for her cat. I mean, this was the middle of the workday. But we stopped, we took time, and we prayed. What did this lead to? The next day she came back and she said, you know, my fear really wasn't for my cat. My cat's not sick. But I figured if you were willing to pray with me about my cat, then I was safe in confiding in you. And she went on to share that her fear was about her dad, who was dying with cancer. And she hadn't talked to him in over 2 years because they'd had a fight. And what she needed was the presence of Christ in her life to give her the courage to go and seek his forgiveness so she could be with him in the end. Folks, don't pour your life into someone else just so that person will like you. Invest yourself, pour your life into someone so that person can become like you. So the person can learn from what you do well, what you learn right. So that person can learn from your mistakes that you've made. So that person can learn from your example of how you trust God in your weaknesses. So that person can become like you as hopefully you are ever more becoming like Christ. Folks, don't waste your life. This morning, think about who has God put in your life to be an influence on? Who does he want you to invest your life in? Who can you be Christ to? If it's your desire, God will give you all the courage you need. Let's pray.